My name is Stuart Merrill, and I woke up this gay. Episode 48, Not So Happy and Gay 4th of July, Part 2. It's sometimes very difficult to recognize moments of extreme historical significance when you're in them. Right now is one of those moments. What we in the LGBTQ plus community and our allies do over the next 2 or 3 years could determine whether we lose everything we have fought for or expand the rights we have achieved until they truly include everyone in our community. If we do nothing, we will most certainly lose everything. This is a very important point, so I'm going to say it again, and probably a few more times throughout the course of this podcast. It is sometimes very difficult to recognize moments of extreme historical significance when you're in them. Right now is one of those moments. That is what came to mind when I read a post on the Facebook page of a very popular young LGBTQ plus activist who had thousands of followers, far, far more than I do. They said, and I quote, "If you're gay instead of queer, fuck off my page." And there were literally thousands of likes. Okay, my second thought upon reading this post was, well, honestly, I wanted to congratulate Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans. They've got this very influential young person with all their social media presence and influence doing their work for them and doing it brilliantly. Well done, Donald. Rather than working together and taking on Trump and the MAGA Republicans to defend the rights of the most vulnerable in our community, and I might add, at an extremely critical time in our history, when we are quite literally on the cusp of losing everything we have fought for a century, this young person has chosen to focus all of their considerable passion, anger, social media savvy, influence, and hatred on members of their own community who define a word and a lifestyle slightly differently than they do. Okay, this might sound strange coming from me, but believe it or not, I kind of get where they're coming from. Or at least there was a time I did. If I'm totally honest, I thought and did pretty much the exact same thing when I was their age. When I first moved back to this country, frankly, I found both the political and social leaders of what we then referred to as the gay community to be absolutely repulsive. They were a bunch of ditto-head, shiny white blonde muscle boys. All of them had the exact same Farrah Fawcett feathered hair. They all looked, dressed, thought, and acted exactly the same way. None of them had any personality or individuality whatsoever. Seriously, you could barely tell these guys apart. They even shaved off their sexy chest hair. I mean, seriously, who does that? Even the music they danced to was trivial and vapid. Frankly, I wanted nothing to do with any of these ridiculous clones. I intentionally avoided these guys for years. Well, other than having sex with them. Hey, what can I say? Grudge sex. Don't knock until you've tried it. The problem was, you see, they were the guys leading the LGBTQ plus rights movement. They also ran the organizations dedicated to helping those of us with HIV/AIDS. Now, in retrospect, I realize I could have spent those very important years working with them for the common good of our community. You don't have to like someone to work with them. Also, at the end of the day, when it came right down to it, on the truly important things that actually mattered, even back then, I agreed with them 98% of the time. I just recoil every time I hear a man say, "Oh, just don't touch my hair." But is that really a valid reason to help Reagan, Bush, and now Trump defeat the LGBTQ plus rights movement? Because I didn't like their hair? Or because some influential young activist doesn't like the way I define the word gay? Okay, I'm sorry, but that shit's crazy. Why are we all so eager to do exactly what our opponents want us to do at such a crucial time in our history? Of course they are winning. We're doing all the work for them. We are defeating ourselves while they successfully hack away at our rights. All they have to do is sit back and watch with big smiles on their evil faces. Okay. I'm going to try to calm down, but seriously, decades later, looking back on that time, I'm now able to recognize a few important mistakes. Number one, people are always most critical of their own community. There's nothing new about that. That's just human nature. In our community, we tend to be a little more critical and downright bitchy, not to mention a whole lot more vicious. We have a well-earned reputation for being extremely cruel to each other. You've heard the saying, divide and conquer? At this moment in our community, far too many of us are very busy dividing and conquering ourselves. Number two, as I mentioned many times before in this podcast, everyone in the fight is crucial. Even people whose tactics, theories, and definitions we disagree with play an important role in our struggle for universal equality, justice, and opportunity. Martin Luther King could not have succeeded to the degree that he did without Malcolm X. They may have appeared to oppose each other in life, but in retrospect, it became clear their, at times, opposing theories and tactics were actually complementary, and together they accomplished remarkable things. Neither of them could have been as successful as they were without the other. Nor could the civil rights movement have advanced as far as it did without both of them, all of them. Believe me, I get it. There are a lot of people in the LGBTQ plus community who rub me the wrong way, and I'm absolutely certain there are a lot of people who can't stand me either, and that's fine. I stopped worrying about that kind of shit years ago. You can hate me all you want, but please, please, stop stopping me from helping you. Please. We must never forget who our real allies are and who our true enemies are. We must focus our passion, our anger, our work, and our considerable social media influence on fighting the people who are truly harming us, not on each other. Now, I'm not suggesting you go on vacation with me, have coffee with me, or even have a pleasant conversation with me. We don't have to be friends. But stop opposing and preventing your allies from trying to accomplish the same things you want to accomplish just because you disagree with them 2% of the time. There's another very important issue that I would be remiss to ignore, and that is the influence of social media and the internet, with COVID as a very effective cherry on top, has turned us all into a bunch of self-segregating radicals. Okay, I'm going to turn this into an I statement, because it doesn't sound quite as preachy as a we statement, and because I'm just as guilty as everybody else here, possibly even more guilty. I've gotten into the habit of seeking out the very few people who agree with me on absolutely every minute detail of my political and social opinions, while eliminating everyone else from my life. So many of us have completely lost the skill of socially interacting with people who agree with us 98% of the time, or more, while respectfully ignoring that 2% where we disagree. I used to be like that. Hell, I made a career out of it once. Recently, I completely eliminated two people from my life, both of whom I totally admire, love, and adore, because we defined a couple of words slightly differently. Both friendships ended in screaming matches over some trivial bullshit in that 2% where we disagree. The LGBTQ plus community has proven over and over again that together we are invincible. Our biggest problem right now is we're just incapable of working together on anything with anybody. And it will be our ultimate downfall. Okay, once again, it is sometimes very difficult to recognize moments of extreme historical significance when you're in them. In the 1980s and 90s, when we were just kids trying to build our adult lives, I was so wrapped up in just living, paying my bills, trying to survive, while working full-time and putting myself through full-time university. I also managed to volunteer delivering food to people with AIDS once a week, and I attended as many protests and political rallies as I could. But I was so busy that it didn't really occur to me then that I was living in one of the most significant and pivotal moments of LGBTQ plus history. Well, guess what? Right now is one of those moments, too. What we in the LGBTQ plus community and our allies do over the next 2 or 3 years could determine whether we lose everything we fought for or expand the rights we have achieved until they truly include everyone in our community. If we do nothing, we will most certainly lose everything. So what are we doing? It appears many of us are extremely busy scratching each other's eyes out over trivial bullshit like temperamental divas. As long as we continue to behave like I did with those two friends, And like that very influential young person on Facebook did, we will continue to lose. And it won't be long before we've lost everything. It's as simple as that. I don't want that to be your legacy. And I've worked too goddamn hard for the past half century to let that become my legacy. I'll be damned if that is our legacy to the next generations of our community. Now, I'm going to take this concept one step further. When Harvey Milk first started his work as an activist and during his early campaigns running for the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, his biggest supporters were retired people, seniors, and the labor unions. Gay leadership at that time in San Francisco actively opposed him. If you listen to my podcast, you know the exact same thing happened to me when I was trying to pass pro-LGBTQ+ legislation in Utah. Now, I've worked with trade union leadership in the past. My first, admittedly very bigoted impression of them was they were the worst stereotype of dirty fingernail, foul-mouthed, misogynistic, dripping in testosterone assholes I had ever encountered. However, you couldn't dismiss them because they are very powerful politically. Maybe it was the same for Harvey Milk, but I was very pleasantly surprised to discover I really liked these guys. A lot. And the very fact that they were such unlikely supporters of LGBTQ+ rights made their support that much more visible, influential, persuasive, and oh so very, very effective. They could often reach demographics that would have never listened to us. Having the support of magnificent mainstream glitterati like Dolly Parton, Susan Sarandon, Betty White, and of course Princess Diana was very important in our movement. They nudged millions of politically and socially moderate people to support us. But when Garth Brooks, Willie Nelson, and Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan's political hero and role model Barry Goldwater, actually started advocating for LGBTQ+ rights and same-sex marriage, now those were watershed moments. It was having the support of such unlikely people and organizations that finally tipped the balance in our favor. In 2012, in the state of Minnesota, they tried to pass a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. A coalition of religious leaders from various faiths approached the LGBTQ+ leadership and asked their permission to fight with our community to defeat the amendment. They wanted to make the religious argument for same-sex marriage and show Minnesotans that many people of faith believe equality is a religious value worth fighting for. The coalition included leaders from a remarkably broad range of traditions. Pastors from the United Methodist Church, clergy from the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, rabbis from Reformed and Conservative Jewish congregations, ministers from the United Church of Christ, Episcopal priests, tons of Episcopal priests, God bless them, Presbyterian clergy, Unitarian Universalist ministers, and clergy from several other mainline Protestant traditions. These religious leaders helped organize hundreds of clergy and congregations across the state. They produced television ads, held press conferences and sermons featuring prominent clergy, telling them their faith required them to support equal marriage rights, not oppose them. They were enormously successful in a way the LGBTQ+ community could never have been. They convinced many moderate and religious voters to vote against the amendment, and it was soundly defeated. Then the following year, Minnesota easily legalized same-sex marriage through legislation. We are all so busy judging, condemning, lecturing, and hating on each other and everybody else that we have no time or energy left to reach out to a very broad spectrum of society that wants to support us at this very critical time when we desperately need their support. I hate to tell you this, but what they did for us in Minnesota, it's not going to happen these days. Do you know why? Because these days nobody dares reach out to us, much less talk to us. We have rightfully earned the reputation of being an intimidating, mean, aggressive, bitter, and angry group of people who constantly corrects and lectures everyone. They see how we treat each other and, worse, how we treat outsiders. They don't want to get near us, and I don't blame them. if I, somebody who has literally been fighting for LGBTQ plus rights for over a half century, am reacting this strongly to our aggressive behavior, just imagine how a politically or socially moderate person, or somebody who voted for Trump, will react. Every time we treat someone that way, we have lost that potential ally for the rest of their life. In Germany, they have a wonderful saying that I've always found very useful. They have a name for people who consciously and or subconsciously are always looking for and creating conflict, often unnecessary conflict, whenever and wherever they can. They call these people conflict horny. Now, I know this doesn't describe everybody in our community. It probably doesn't even describe the majority of our community. But it describes enough of the loudest members of our community that it truly has become our reputation. As a straight friend of mine once told me, I mostly avoid your people because y'all are such nasty bitches to each other. I'm afraid that's how you'll treat me. Once again, I hate to break it to you, but that is a very common attitude. People are afraid of us. We have the reputation of being bitchy, mean, and aggressive, always eager to lecture and criticize anyone. So let me ask you a question. Would you rather be right or live in a society where you have rights? Lord knows our community has been wronged for many, many generations. Now that we finally have enough recognition and status in society that we can correct people, which is very new, by the way, I certainly understand the appeal of doing so. But do you understand the price we pay for doing that? Once again, I ask you, would you rather be right or live in a world where you have rights? Our current behavior has brought us to a point where that is our choice. Far too many of us are choosing the former at the cost of the latter. Look, I understand, after being victimized for 50 years, it feels great to finally get to correct somebody, to chastise people, and to let them know what I really think. It is very gratifying to be right. But it's a short-term feeling that comes at an extremely high long-term price. Hey guys, Stuart here. I'm very excited to announce I have my first sponsor, and it's a great one. It's called Brown Bear Herbs. Now, I don't know about you, but I've quit smoking and various nicotine products every Monday since about 1989. Quitting nicotine in its various forms is the most challenging thing I've ever done. I've tried everything and nothing worked until now. Brown Bear Herbs has an amazing line of herbal cigarettes and teas formulated to help you quit smoking, and it really works. It's amazing. I've chosen to use mostly the Brown Bear Herbal Tea Blend, Take It Easy. It's made with herbs traditionally used to support nicotine withdrawal. I have a cup of Take It Easy first thing in the morning right after my coffee, and then again mid-afternoon. For the next few hours, I don't even think about cigarettes, vapes, or nicotine pouches, which is my latest addiction. Brown Bear Herbs offers many other herbal products, teas, tinctures, and essences to support your wellness goals. I'm going to talk more about that in the future. In the meantime, if you're struggling to quit tobacco products like I did, you should definitely check out brownbearherbs.com. You'll be very glad you did. I know I am. For 20% off Brown Bear Herbs products and consultations, enter discount code WOKEUPGAY. All one word, all lowercase. Outside of our community, there are scores of influential people and organizations who passionately believe we should have equal rights and would eagerly support us. But they are afraid to even talk to us, and I don't blame them. Hell, I'm afraid to talk to us. Okay, again, I need to calm down. So, historically speaking, by far the most effective tool in our quiver has always been what I jokingly refer to as missionary work. As I mentioned in my last podcast, part one, when I first started this struggle, we had 14% of America supporting us. Now it's 85%. When you do the math, that is a quarter of a billion with a B people whose attitudes we changed and who now vote in our favor. How did we do that in just one generation? Missionary work. Well, that's what I like to call it, but that's just because of my Mormon background. I think it's funny to call it missionary work. Some people call it diplomatic work or networking. When you do it right, people just think you're being friendly. Whatever you call it, it works better than anything else we've ever done. Believe me when I tell you, in the past 50 years, we tried everything. There is nothing you can possibly imagine that we have not already tried. And nothing was as effective as good old-fashioned missionary work. It can be tedious and boring, but I've been doing it for over 40 years. My entire generation has. And that is how we change the minds of 7 out of 10 Americans. A lot of my transgender friends are really, really great at this, and I see them doing it all the time. But there needs to be more of you, more of all of us. One by one, we need to befriend and earn the respect of ideally around 100 million Americans. I know that sounds impossible, but it's really not. My generation already did it once with 250 million Americans. It's going to take a very long time, possibly the rest of your life. It's not fun. It's downright tedious sometimes. But historically speaking, nothing any of us or our allies have ever done has proven as effective. Now, I'm not talking about befriending the easy people, the liberals, and the young people who already vote like us. I mean the conservatives, the Republicans, and the right-wing Christians, some of whom will be extremely reluctant to speak with you. In my generation, the people in our community who made the biggest difference also got the least recognition. I'm talking about those courageous, quiet, queer couples who live in places like northern Idaho, central Arizona, the Smoky Mountains, Appalachia, and in small farming communities all over the Midwest. They just went about their everyday lives, treating the neighbors with kindness and respect, and letting everyone see that though they might be queer or transgender or whatever, they're just normal people like everybody else. Having grown up in a very conservative Christian environment, I can tell you conservatives have one major weakness that is very easy to exploit. They like being kind, nice, and polite to people. They will go to great lengths to avoid conflict. If you chat them up, they will be polite and kind. You don't have to tell them about or lecture them on anything. As a matter of fact, where my LGBTQ+ lifestyle goes, I only ever discuss it if they ask, and eventually many of them do. I always make certain they understand I'm gay in the first few seconds, but other than that, I don't bring it up again unless they do. Just be friendly, respectful, and let them get to know you. Now, a friend of mine rightly argued, it is not her responsibility to correct other people's bigotry. Of course, she's absolutely right. It's not her responsibility to teach other people to stop being bigots. However, I believe, and you don't have to agree with me here, but I believe it is all of our responsibility to leave the next generation of LGBTQ+ youth a better world than the one we were born into. And I believe this is the best way to do that. So, once again, would you rather be right or live in a world where you have rights? It's very easy for conservatives to vote against LGBTQ+ rights in the abstract, when they don't know anyone who will be affected by these laws. However, when we put faces and names on the issue, when we become that sweet lesbian couple down the block, you know the one, every time it snows, they are the first ones out shoveling the walk of the widow that lives next door. Or that darling barista down at the mall. She always compliments my clothes and makes me laugh. I swear every morning she has a new joke. And somebody told me the other day that she's transgender, but you know what? I don't care because I really like her. When they learn our names, come to like and respect us, it is very difficult for them to vote against us. Anytime I get on an airplane, I usually wait until there's only about 20 minutes left in the flight. Then I chat up the person next to me, especially if it's a conservative housewife or a businessman. Within the first few seconds, I always make certain they know I'm gay. I'm very pleasant and respectful to them. I ask them about their kids. Everybody likes to talk about their own children. I look for common interests we can chat about. I intentionally avoid politics or religion or anything that might be contentious. I tell them what a pleasure it was to meet them. And I compliment their kids again and I leave. Then I secretly think to myself, there's one more. I have been doing that every opportunity I got for over 40 years. As I said, a lot of you are already doing this, especially in the transgender community, and you guys are great at it. So please keep it up. Get your friends to start doing it. I don't have to tell you how tedious it can be, though. I mean, honestly, there are times I think to myself, God, do I really have to do this again? Then I remind myself why I'm doing it and who I'm doing it for, and I dive in and do it again. At times, it can be frightening and intimidating approaching some of these people, and I fully understand as a cis man, it is easier for me. There are times when your own personal safety has to take priority, and I totally get that. That being said, let me ask you one question, and please be brutally honest with yourself when you answer this question. How much of your decision process, when you're determining who you will socially interact with, is based on bias, bigotry, and fear of certain stereotypes? I hate to tell you, but avoiding a person because you think they might belong to a particular stereotype, even if it's a homophobic straight man, is still a form of bigotry. The bottom line here is we're trying to teach other people to stop being prejudiced against us, right? I and my entire generation of gay activists had to learn the hard way that asking other people to address their prejudice, bigotry, and biases against us, while refusing to address our own prejudices against others, was not only extremely counterproductive and preventing us from succeeding, it is also immoral and unjust. My entire generation of gay men had to come to terms with our very justifiable hatred and fear of straight men. In the 1980s in this country, when I was in my 20s, fag-bashing and fag-bashing murders were socially acceptable entertainment. Nobody cared when fags were beaten or murdered. The police did nothing about it. Usually they didn't even investigate these crimes. Quite often, it was the police who were assaulting us. I could not begin to count the times I was assaulted. I even witnessed a fag-bashing murder. The armed policeman standing right next to me also witnessed the entire murder from beginning to end. Not only did he refuse to save this poor young man's life, and he was armed, he could have very easily stopped it, but he refused to even take my witness statement. In those days, the vast majority of America could not have cared less that this was happening to us. I was also the victim of institutionalized violence. I was brutally and systematically beaten throughout the second half of my childhood on the orders of my Mormon bishop, a straight man, of course. I spent the first decade of my adult life terrified of and hating all straight men in positions of authority. However, at one point, a very kind man I worked for pointed out to me that my albeit very justified fear and hatred of men was actually a prejudice, and it was only hurting me. It was holding me back from success. At some point, my entire generation of gay men, the few of us who survived, had to come to terms with that fact. Our very justified hatred of heterosexual men wasn't hurting them one bit. It was only hurting us. It was preventing us from succeeding in our fight for universal equality. Hey guys, Stuart here. Thanks to you, in the past couple months, I've increased my listenership almost tenfold. Well, actually sevenfold, and I still need about 30% more listeners than I currently have for I Woke Up This Gay to become financially self-sustainable. So I'm asking for your help. This is a labor of love for me, but it's more expensive than I originally thought. The monthly fees to post this podcast recently doubled. I'd like a new sound system to better interview my guests. I also hope to start videoing my podcasts so I can put them on YouTube. But most importantly, I'm in desperate need of a new computer. The 10-year-old computer I have now literally crashes every few minutes, and it more than doubles the amount of time I need to produce this podcast. First of all, please help me by sharing this podcast with everyone you know. Secondly, I've put up a GoFundMe page for a new computer. I'm trying to raise $1,100. That's the amount I need for the computer that will best serve my needs. I've included a link to my GoFundMe page at the top of the description. Lastly, I want to thank you. Thank you for sharing my podcast, but most importantly, I want to thank you for sharing my passion to make this a more inclusive, kind, loving, and accepting world for everyone, especially our children and our youth. Let's give them the safe and worry-free future they deserve, the future we all dream of. And please don't forget, share, share, share. There's one more topic I think needs to be discussed. Most younger generations have a hard time understanding my generation's attitude on the weaponized word debate. You know, words like faggot or fag. Younger generations take the use of weaponized words extremely seriously, and of course they have every right to. However, my generation tends to take a more laissez-faire approach to these words, a yeah, whatever sort of approach. On an intellectual level, of course I understand the extreme pain these words can cause. That's why when I was a lobbyist, we fought very hard at the federal level and in the state of Utah to pass hate crimes legislation, and I'm really proud to say that we succeeded. Basically, what that means is if somebody punches you in the nose, you can be prosecuted. But if they punch you in the nose while calling you a faggot, there will be additional penalties. Let me explain why old farts like me just don't take weaponized words quite as seriously as younger generations do. First of all, I hate to break it to you, but younger people have always taken themselves more seriously. We did when we were that age. Our parents did when they were your age. It's just human nature. In time, you will begin to take yourself less and less seriously. You will discover it is just a part of maturity. I have no doubt today's youth will discover the same thing. However, and this is the part that might need a little more explanation. In my day, if somebody called you a faggot or whatever, there was very rarely any social condemnation from anybody who happened to overhear it. Unless you happened to be in front of a gay bar, no one would defend you. Basically, back then, if somebody called me a faggot, my first concern was safety. I couldn't have cared less about an insulting word. Our concern was violence. You just had to get the hell out of there as fast as possible, any way you possibly could, period. At that time, society's total lack of concern about anti-gay violence is reflected in the fact that there are no national statistics on the subject until 1990, when people finally started paying attention. In 1996, 20% of gay men had been assaulted, and that does not include the men who were murdered. In the mid-1980s, as a result of AIDS, the already rampant anti-gay violence spiked dramatically. There are no statistics because, even in places like San Francisco, famously, the most frequent abusers were the police, so who are we going to report it to? The point I'm trying to make is this. Though I have no statistical evidence that can prove it, in the 1980s, we were the victims of violence dramatically more, 10, maybe 20 times more than anything anyone is experiencing today in this country. Honestly, I cannot think of a single gay man I knew who was not either the witness or a victim of anti-gay violence in the 1980s, and most of us experienced it multiple times. Off the top of my head, I can count 4 times that it happened to me in the 1980s, once as a witness and 3 times when I was attacked. And that's not even counting my violently bigoted Mormon childhood or the constant verbal assaults. That's just the physical violence. And half of that decade I spent in Europe, where anti-gay violence wasn't really as big a problem. So, during the 5 years from that decade that I was in America, I was physically attacked 3 times that I can remember, and I witnessed 1 murder. And that was in Chicago and New York, cities that at that time were considered safer than most. For us, anyway. So, for us, weaponized words were synonymous with violence, and it was the violence we were concerned about, not the words. We decided to take a very different approach. If we reclaimed words like fag or faggot, if we owned them, if we jokingly, even respectfully and lovingly call each other faggots, freaks, and whores, we very effectively de-weaponized those words. And as a footnote, this was another very important bit of wisdom we learned from our mentors, role models, and heroes in the African American community. When we took back the power, they could no longer use these words against us. We actually had a great deal of fun turning these vicious and violent words into humorous terms of endearment. Besides, some of these phrases weren't that offensive in the first place. I mean, shirtlifter? Though the people screaming it most certainly meant it as an insult. I think shirtlifter is kind of charming. It's an adorable way to describe who and what I am. Anyway, the result of our decision to de-weaponize these words was amazing. It was downright shocking how easy and effective de-weaponizing words was. What surprised me most was how people reacted to our decision to de-weaponize these words. People outside of our community really admired us for it. What they admired most was how we took this horribly terrifying crisis of violence and murder and turned it into something to laugh at and have fun with. as far as the violent homophobes were concerned, I saw it work countless times with them too. They would start harassing us, calling us faggots or whatever. Of course, they were planning to go on and physically assault us. Then, surprisingly, we responded not with violence, not even with defensiveness or fear, but with pride, ownership, and humor. We responded by saying, "Hell yeah, I'm a faggot, and so is he. Damn proud of it, too." Then we laughed and simply walked away. And do you know what happened? So did they. So did they. Every time we did that, the baseball bats and 2x4s went back into the beds of their monster trucks, and they drove back to their suburbs. It literally de-escalated the violence every single time. It was like magic, and we had fun. But most importantly, we gained people's respect. We learned self-respect. And we literally saved lives. We just didn't have the luxury of discussing how bad words or being misgendered made us feel, though it happened constantly. We were far more concerned with our safety, staying alive, and taking care of our friends who were dying of AIDS. Look, today when other people have to endure weaponized words, being insulted or misgendered, I take it very seriously. I am in no way trying to minimize that experience for someone else. However, when it happens to me, frankly, I couldn't care less. If somebody calls me a girl or a faggot, my instinctual reaction is to just laugh at them. They actually think those words have power over me, but they just don't. That may sound a bit condescending to some, and if so, I'm really sorry. That is genuinely not my intent. I am not suggesting anyone else think about or respond to this issue the same way I and most of my generation does. That is not at all the point I'm trying to make here. I'm simply trying to help you understand why I and my generation just can't take the weaponized word debate quite as seriously as younger generations do. It was just such an insignificant problem to us compared to everything else we were dealing with at the time. Honest to God, my first reaction every time I hear young people getting all passionate about this, I think to myself, bravo, good for them that they're addressing this issue and making other people face it. Then I ask myself, do they have any idea how incredibly fortunate they are to have inherited a world where this gets to be one of their biggest concerns? We just didn't have that luxury. But I'm absolutely thrilled that you do. Okay, so once again, I am in no way trying to minimize their feelings, your concerns, and your focus on these topics. I merely hope that you can grasp how fortunate you are that this is what you get to focus on. Actually, I am enormously proud of the fact that these are among your biggest problems now. Okay, as I said in episode 1, what younger generations of Americans have inherited from your straight elders bites the big one. Between the affordability crisis, the housing crisis, and the political nightmare, it is just so unfair that this is the reality you have inherited from them. However, what younger generations have inherited from us, your LGBTQ plus elders, is one of the most remarkable transformations of societal norms and attitudes in human history. And right now we are at the risk of losing all of it, everything we devoted our entire lives to achieving. So one last time, it's sometimes very difficult to recognize moments of extreme historical significance when you're in them. Right now is one of those moments. You are far from the first generation of Americans to have to set aside their dreams and fix the mess you were born into. Do you think my generation wanted our whole lives to be about AIDS and fighting for the basic human rights that we should have had in the first place? Do you think my parents' generation wanted their childhoods to be about the Depression and their youth to be fighting in World War II? While I know a great number of our youth already understand this, far too many of you need to stop complaining, suck it up, and get her done. As my generation hands you the baton, grasp it with enormous pride and the knowledge that the remarkable legacy we are giving you is unparalleled in modern human history. Grasp it with humility, knowing that you will achieve even greater things than we did. Grasp it with confidence that though you have a lot of work ahead of you and it's not going to be easy, you're a queer. We are queers. And when queers work together, there is nothing we cannot accomplish. Be proud of who we are, all of us, and do not stop until every single one of us in the LGBTQ plus family, especially our transgender community, has the same rights and opportunities as everybody else. Okay, just because I'm me, I can't really finish a podcast without telling at least one story. So, on the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, I flew to New York City to celebrate. Have you ever had one of those conversations with a stranger that stuck with you for the rest of your life? On that flight, I sat next to a beautiful, very elegant African-American woman who was a few years older than me, though she most certainly didn't look it. Normally on flights, especially long ones, I put on my headphones and pretend I'm listening to whatever. I read, write, or watch a movie, but I make a point of not speaking with the person next to me until there's about 20 minutes left in the flight. Then I do my missionary work, say goodbye, and get off the plane. Experience has taught me that chances are pretty low the person sitting next to me is somebody that I'm going to want to talk to for several hours. However, I have a weakness for African-American women, especially our elders. Though I do find them a bit intimidating sometimes. You see, I remember the Reagan years, the budget cuts, the extreme poverty, the violence, the crack wars. I remember watching those remarkable African-American mothers and grandmothers who, against all odds, somehow, miraculously held their families and communities together, armed with nothing more than love, grit, spit, the fear of God, and the fear of their mothers. They raised one generation of children after another. Hell, some of them are still raising kids. And those kids, how they respect, obey, love, and admire these tenacious ladies. Anyway, suffice it to say, I was not going to pass up a chance to speak with this remarkable lady sitting next to me. In America, we may not have aristocracy, but we most certainly have nobility. And that generation of African-American mothers and grandmothers is America's true nobility. This lovely lady sitting next to me did not disappoint either. Her parents had started her early. She was just a teenager when they brought her to the March on Washington. She was actually there and heard MLK deliver his I Have a Dream speech. Can you imagine? She was also the person who introduced me to my all-time favorite gay hero, the organizer of that 1963 March on Washington, Bayard Rustin. She even got to hear him speak that day. I was just in awe of this lady. She was a physician, and most doctors her age were already enjoying a hard-earned retirement, but not this lady. Not only was she still working on the front lines, but she was helping mostly disadvantaged white and Latino children in eastern Oregon, an area famous for having the highest population of white supremacists in America. Speaking with this remarkable woman was the perfect start for my celebratory trip. We spent 4 hours swapping stories, honoring each other's fallen friends, learning about each other's communities a little more. We cried a bit. Oh my God, we laughed a lot. I think we spent most of that flight just laughing. So much so that when I got up to leave, I turned to her and I said, you know what? As heartbreaking and hard as those times were, now that I think back, not only am I incredibly proud, but I realize in spite of all the heartbreak and hardship, those were the happiest times of my life. Once again, she burst out laughing and said, you're only figuring that out now, son? My generation was defined by AIDS. It's not what we wanted, but it's what we got. So we set our dreams aside, rolled up our sleeves, and we got to work. We devoted our lives to fighting for your rights. We were fully aware of the fact that the vast majority of us would be dead long before we saw the results of our work. But we kept working anyway, with what limited time we had left. We believed it was our responsibility to give the next generations of our community a better world than the one we were born into. I am enormously proud of the legacy my generation is giving you. And now it's your turn. It's going to be hard. However, I'm confident when you're my age, you'll look back with pride, knowing you became one of America's greatest generations. You simply have to. The alternative is just unthinkable. So, 43 years from now, when you're celebrating the 100th anniversary of Pride? What will you say to the person sitting next to you? What will they say to you? I hope you're proud. Proud of what you inherited from us, and even more proud of what you are giving to the generations that will follow you. Okay, one last thing. If y'all do a truly amazing job like my generation did, the next generation will look at you with a blank stare, having no idea what the hell you're even talking about. They will take the rights you fought so hard and longed for completely for granted. If you truly do a remarkable job, the next generation will just assume it has always been that way. And you know what? That's how you'll know you succeeded. So 43 years from now, when you have this conversation, I hope you think of me. Because I will be saying, well done. You made us proud. My name is Stuart Merrill. And once again, I am extremely proud to say I woke up this gay. Happy 4th of July, everybody.